The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Carrying on regardless, Theresa May survives a no-confidence vote, but what next? Calls for an inquiry as costs for the National Children's Hospital escalate. And as the INMO strike gets ever closer, are we paying our nurses enough? All that and more on tonight's Late Debate. But first the news with Sharon Tobin. Thanks, Sharon. Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate with Katie Hannan. Joining us tonight in studio, we have Fine Gael TD for Louth, Fergus O'Dowd, Deputy Lisa Chambers, Brexit spokesperson for Fianna Fáil, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin spokesperson on health, political reporter with the Irish Times, Jennifer Bray, and public affairs consultant and Irish Examiner columnist, Gerard Howlin. Now, we want to hear from you, so please do get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email us on latedebate at rte.ie, or tweet to at latedebate.rte. Now, as we come to you, we were hearing that Theresa May was due to be outside Downing Street to make a statement. Exactly now, actually, at a couple of minutes past 10. But the latest we've heard is that she was hoping to make that statement live into the BBC 10 o'clock news. I'm just hearing, getting word that she is there, so we will bring you that statement as soon as we can. But in the meantime, we're going to go to Brussels because joining me on the line now is Shona Murray, European correspondent with Euronews. Shona, is Michelle Barnier's analysis today of what happened in Westminster that has pushed us closer to a no-deal Brexit, is that the view generally held by the powers that be there in Brussels?
I think it's really hard to say. Because, you know, some people thought that it sort of took a no-deal scenario off the table. But I think it's really just very, very hard to say at the moment because on one hand, you have an expectation that that there will be a request for an extension of Article 50. But on the other hand, we see how defined Theresa May is, that she doesn't want to do that. And she's not going to be removed as Prime Minister and she's not going to be removed as leader of the Conservative Party. So that means that you could see the UK slip into a no-deal scenario. But at the same time, there isn't a consensus for that. So it depends on what happens in her meetings with members of the opposition over the next 24 hours. We know we've got confirmation today that the EU is open to entertaining a request of Article 50 extension, but that would depend on what that would look like. Would it be to hold a second referendum? It's not likely to be for a general election anyway. And then also there's been an offer very clearly by Angela Merkel today, by Michel Barnier and by others that if they wish to maybe let's look at the future relationship, the political declaration of the future relationship and soften red lines in relation to single market and customs union, that could also be something on the table for as well. But again, we know that in the UK there's quite a lot of resistance to that too, single market being obviously freedom of movement, customs union meaning that they can't operate their own independent trade policy. So we haven't really gone much further down the line than we were a year ago, actually.
I imagine there, as in the UK, as in Dublin, there must be much speculation over what might be Mrs. May's plan B. What would be welcomed? I know, as you said there, that anything that would bring you back into the single market or bring us back into single market and the customs union, that's sort of a Norway or a Norway plus. Is there any genuine hope that that might be on the table again?
It's certainly the path of least resistance that there will be an extension of Article 50 for one of those reasons. Because remember, you know, from the start and consistently the EU said obviously it doesn't want any Brexit, but the second Brexit option will be single market and customs union. And then the third option was this one with the backstop. So all along that's been the case. And, nobody wants the backstop scenario. That's another thing that hasn't been really, you know, digested in the UK because, you know, when you look at the language in Britain, the backstop is all about trapping Britain within the EU customs orbit. But in actual fact, you know, first, most member states don't want it, particularly the fact that it's UK-wide because of issues in relation to state aid, also concerns that the UK might be getting access to the single market for goods through the back door. So it isn't a very welcome option. It was something that the EU decided to do at the last minute because they hoped that it would mean that Theresa May could get it over the line as part of the withdrawal agreement. She wasn't able to sell it. I don't think she even tried to sell it. you know, so that's one issue that just really hasn't been been realised in Britain yet.
I'll just stop you there, yeah. Seana, for a moment, because I'm just hearing that we have a clip of Theresa May from outside Downing Street. I think she's been talking about her desire for cross-party support to deliver Brexit. But let's hear that clip now.
I have just held constructive meetings with the leader of the Liberal Democrats and the Westminster leaders of the SNP and Plaid Cymru. From tomorrow, meetings will be taking place between senior government representatives, including myself, and groups of MPs who represent the widest possible range of views from across Parliament, including our confidence and supply partners, the Democratic Unionist Party. I am disappointed that the leader of the Labour Party has not so far chosen to take part, but our door remains open. It will not be an easy task, but MPs know they have a duty to act in the national interest, reach a consensus, and get this done.
That's Theresa May speaking outside Downing Street in the last few moments. Seana, I don't think that's really taking us much further. We're not really getting any sense of what she's going to be discussing with across the House with those other party members.
Well, I think what's interesting, though, is the fact that, you know, while the backstop is so misunderstood and it's so toxic in Britain, many people voted against the deal or the withdrawal treaty today. Yesterday?
Yesterday.
During this week, anyway. because they want to remain within the EU because they want a second referendum.
But I don't think Jeremy Corbyn is one of those people, though, Seana, is he?
Exactly. And not only that, I mean, he's this idea of remaining in the customs union as part of managing the border and, you know, having a strong future relationship with Britain. And he also thinks that by doing that, the UK would be allowed a vote on the customs union. And he's wrong. You can't have a vote on the EU Customs Union unless you're a member of the EU. Of course, you can be, you know, your opinions can be facilitated and listened to, but they wouldn't actually be able to have an international trade policy. So the Labour Party's position is quite far removed as well. It doesn't really solve any of the issues. The backstop requires, as we know, it needs customs checks and, you know, non-tariff barriers to be resolved before any of that happens. And then you have also this conundrum that we'll see if it has to be managed over the European Parliament elections, because because we're on uncharted waters. If they decided they want to have a second referendum, then as an EU member state, they may be legally obliged to hold elections in May and then have a referendum and then decide to leave. So
that would have implications, wouldn't it, for Ireland
and
in terms of this, our extra MEPs. Yeah, that would be quite disappointing to a number of candidates.
The option could be that you would, if it's for a referendum, that you would delay the parliamentary elections in May because the UK might be obliged to hold an election because it will still be a member state. And if you look at the European Court of Justice ruling just before Christmas, the ruling stated that, you know, the UK has a right unilaterally not to extend Article 50, but to revoke it if there is an extension. It's another conundrum anyway.
Okay,
that we could be looking down.
One of many, many, many conundrums. Seana Murray, thank you for joining us with that latest update from Brussels this evening. I want to go to my panel now. Lisa Chambers, looking at what's happened over the last 24 hours and the analysis that we're hearing coming out of Brussels today, I mean, do you think that Theresa May, or whoever it will be at that point, will take the UK out of the EU with no deal? Do you think that would actually be a tenable move for a British Prime Minister?
I don't think she'll do it intentionally. My concern is that, you know, simply because something is terrible doesn't mean it won't happen. And because there isn't a clear majority for any option, and I know Seana mentioned Norway plus plus, and we're here in Canada, but I mean, Norway plus plus facilitates movement of people. So that was really one of the key issues the entire referendum was run on in the first place.
Certainly Theresa May's main red line as from the outset.
I'm glad you mentioned red lines, because her red lines and the UK government's red lines are what led us to the current withdrawal deal as it stands. And there was a huge concession given by the EU, and Seana touched upon that, and that was the UK-wide customs union. Initially, Barnier and the team said no to that because other member states had huge concerns around this UK-wide customs union, a backdoor into the single market. So that was a big concession from the EU's perspective, and that really hasn't been taken up by the UK in that manner. They feel as though this has been foisted on them, even though they actually requested this. As it stands, okay, the deal was rejected by Parliament yesterday, but it hasn't actually been officially rejected by the UK government. So the deal is technically, as dead as it might seem, it's still on the table.
And the only deal on the table.
So they need to now either decide to reject the deal officially, or try and maybe put it to another vote again, or do something with it. If that doesn't happen, you know, I mean, Theresa May, obviously, her government won the vote tonight, or they've survived tonight's vote, and she kind of stumbles further on. But this idea that she can talk cross-party, I mean, I don't understand what the objective of that is, actually. What's the intention of those talks, and where is she hoping to lead it to? Does she want to go back to Brussels now? She has been told time and time again that the deal will not be reopened. The deal is currently there, will not be reopened. So she either has to reject that deal or accept it,
Louise,
and see where they're going.
Put yourself in Theresa May's head today. if that's not too big an ask. Where do you think she's going with this? What do you think she's going to get from these cross-party discussions and discussions with the DUP? And
it's, as I said to you, to your researcher, it's tough to make predictions, as Yogi Bear said, especially about the future. But it really, really is hard to know. And it is difficult to understand. If you could understand what was the thinking of Mrs. May, you'd have to ask her, first of all, why did you call the election when you did? And many people have questioned her political judgment. But I suppose people then say, well, I question her political judgment, but I don't doubt her tenacity, because she certainly is hanging on. It's hard to see, with the scale of the rejection yesterday, what can be achieved by cross-party talks, other than the capacity to point the finger at Jeremy Corbyn and try and shift some blame onto him. And perhaps that's what she's doing. I'm not sure there's much value in that either. But taking individual groups of MPs in and exploiting the differences that exist, not just within the Labour Party, but within our own party, it's hard to see how there's going to be any result out of that, given the scale. If it was a small number, well, then those talks might have some impact. But given the scale of the defeat yesterday, it's very difficult to see what could be potentially achieved by having those cross-party talks.
Gerard?
I think the big move on next week, if it comes, is that in a situation where the UK government has clearly lost its political authority in the House of Commons, is whether institutionally it will actually lose its writ. And by that I mean is the role of the Speaker, Brecow, what is he going to do next? Because she will come into the House of Commons on Monday because he utterly upended all precedent to accept Dominic Grieve's amendment and put her in that position. My question, which I have no answer, is what is he going to do next? Is he, for example, going to accept a bill from Nick Bowles and others that would give the House of Commons itself, as distinct from the government, the role of proposing and voting on one option after another serial basis? So what I'm saying is that it is within the bounds of real possibility, but not certainty, that effectively you would have a constitutional coup in Britain next week, where the House of Commons takes the role of government onto itself.
An interesting point you're making is they could effectively put all of the options forward.
Correct.
And they could all be defeated.
Yes, but that will bring complete clarity.
Absolutely. Well,
in a horrible way.
Nothing else is left but stay.
Complete clarity, but in a fairly chaotic manner, because I think the only thing that they have managed to unite behind is that they don't want a no-deal Brexit, but they cannot decide what sort of Brexit.
But they haven't united there either, because there is a significant number of hard Brexit.
The only majority...
They would like
the only majority that exists is against a no deal Brexit.
Yeah.
But it is hard to understand what it is that they want. And if we just cast our mind back, you know, only a short few years here when we had the referendum on the Eighth Amendment, in the run up to that, we had a huge amount of discussion. Citizens Assembly, we had the committee, we had all of that discussion, a lot of public discourse. So when people went into the ballot box on the 25th of May, they knew what they were voting for. I think the difficulty, and you know, I'm sure if Mrs. May is listening in, as I'm sure she often does, Katie, if she's listening, you know, the benefit of my advice won't be helpful unless I can provide her with a time machine. But actually, if you were going to embark on something like Brexit again, the thing to do is to do what was done with the referendum, to have that public discourse, to have that dialogue, to have certainty in the minds of people. Because I think for every British citizen that voted, there is a different view of what Brexit actually means to them. So I think that part of that is the difficulty, because, you know, to a certain extent, you're not going to satisfy people on the basis that they all voted for something individually. But equally, what's come out of it now appears to be satisfying absolutely nobody. And they wasted 2 years on internal Tory party infighting and, you know, looking inside their own party, squabbling, resignations, all of that. And at the end of it now, they're sort of looking, well, we might need more time. I was kind of, well, like, you've had 2 years of this. They squandered the 2 years that they had.
They run the risk as well, Katie, of, you know, there's only so much time the EU are going to give them as well. You know, they might apply for an extension. I think that Ireland should facilitate that, regardless of whether there's a plan in place or not. If they look for more time, we should absolutely support that. But this isn't going to be allowed to go on forever. So, you know, D-Day will come. They will have to make a call eventually.
It's not going to be allowed to go on at all unless there is some indication that we're going to a place course, that might be acceptable.
I disagree with you on that point. If it comes to 28th of March, for example, the day before, and the UK government say, we don't know where we're going and what's happening, but we need more time, I think Ireland should be supporting that, because I know that's far better than crashing out.
I think that in one sense, being in a parliament is a bubble. And I think the problem with the UK is that there are a lot of people looking at investing in the UK or investing outside of it. There's huge business decisions being made by companies who are very worried about Brexit, and continuing and long-term insecurity of decision-making will delay those investments. And if I could just make the point that I think the kingmaker here could be Corbyn. In other words, he has 256 votes there. And I think that, and he is in favour of some sort of a customs union. And I think that between, if Theresa May is genuine, I think she is genuine about not wanting a hard Brexit, I think that some deal could be struck there and they'll have a majority and work out a deal with the consent of Europe. That's the only positive way forward. And I think as to chaos.
Well, Fiona Murray was telling us there, Jeremy Corbyn seems to believe that you could be in the customs union.
And at the
table.
There's great clarity in the vote in the United Kingdom Parliament. They're not going for what Theresa May wants, so that's it. And Europe recognises that. I think France and Germany ministers today were saying yes, and the Irish government and others saying yes, we go for the extension of Article 50. But the problem is that the only tangible, real way is for moderate people to get together. Now, the difficulty tonight...
You think Jeremy Corbyn's moderate?
No, he's not. No, that's what I'm saying. He isn't. He wanted the no Brexit deal off the table before he would talk to
Well,
that.
How about this?
But that's playing games, I think.
Well, Jeremy Corbyn does not command the loyalty or the affection of his own parliamentary party. Right. They cordially detest him.
Yeah, but so that's another complication. If you're sitting there somewhere in the parliament, you want a government. You don't want things to collapse. You want investment to continue. You want jobs to grow. You don't want a hard Brexit. No way. And the majority for the number for a hard Brexit was very...
I want to bring Jennifer in.
So that's the reality.
Watching this unfold and it's like a very slow car crash, inevitably heading towards the wall. There does seem to be a terror amongst even moderate, smart MPs to say the word out loud, people's vote, or to say, to indicate in any way that 52% majority shouldn't be absolutely respected in every way. There does seem to be a terror of in any way questioning that. Yeah, I'm just seeing now two Labour MPs, Lisa Nandy and Stella Creasy, are calling for a citizens' assembly, citing Ireland as a good example of how it could work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's now, I know the referendum on the Eighth Amendment and the issues around that are obviously totally different to Brexit, but it was an example of how you can have a dialogue with people and, you know, form a consensus around an issue and bring the public with you. So I definitely think that that idea has merit. And I think the point that you were making in terms of this sort of reluctance to talk about a people's vote or the 52%, there's a huge fear of this sort of social unrest or of, you know, taking away what was effectively the will of the people. But we're in a situation now where it's complete deadlock. And the question on everybody's lips, as we're talking about here tonight, is what happens next? And there seems to be only a few scenarios. One of them is a no deal, and that's the default. And the second one is to delay Article 50, potentially hold a second referendum. And then, of course, the other option would be around changing the deal and entering a customs union or single market. But there doesn't seem to be enough support for any one of those things in and of itself.
Or a no Brexit at all.
And of course, what's fueling a lot of irresponsibility is the Fixed Term Parliament Act. I mean, if anyone ever waves that sheet of nonsense around this country, I hope they're, you know.
Because it has effectively made the Tory party unwhippable, really, hasn't it?
And because you can't whip without fear. It's not possible, I'm sorry. I know that's a very blunt thing to say. But you have three TDs here tonight, and they know that if they vote a major issue down, there's an immediate consequence of a general election. You know, if a similar thing had been enacted. But you can do that repeatedly now in Westminster, and there's no fear of
it. It's the ultimate moral hazard.
Oh, it is.
But it does undermine the government. I mean, the losing votes, and it happens in our own parliament the odd time, as Fergus knows. But losing, when the government loses votes,
it will continue until we have a general election.
It does undermine the authority beyond that, Fergus. Government. And it has undermined, I think, Theresa May's authority, the fact that she has lost. She has lost a large number of votes. That is destabilising.
It's now full of turkeys, but there's no Christmas. It's an appalling scenario.
Can I somebody go back in? If there was, would they vote?
Well, somebody said yesterday that the turkeys aren't going to vote for Christmas.
Sorry, what did you say, Lisa?
I said, somebody was saying yesterday that the turkeys are not going to vote for Christmas. They're not going to precipitate a general election and put themselves on the block.
But you don't have to. There's no risk.
Absolutely, yeah.
Can I go back into our parliament in the Dáil and what Micheál Martin was saying today as regards what we're being told about the contingency planning. Lisa,
I've big issues around this particular topic because, and I've obviously spoken to my party leader on this, and I'm the party's Brexit spokesperson. We are the main opposition party, and there's an extension of confidence in supply because we facilitated it to ensure that we didn't have an election right now and we have stability. So we expect to get information on Brexit, and it's been like pulling teeth all the way through, if I'm being honest about it. We're being drip-fed information. We're getting it after the media sometimes, which I think is a complete disregard for the Parliament. I want to give you an example of why I'm saying this. Just before the Christmas, December 19th, the House is about to rise for the Christmas recess. The government's contingency action plan, the document outlining government policy and what they're doing and planning, 10 to 9, and the House rises 10 minutes later. That's when I got that. And I know for a fact I got it after the media. So I think that's actually dismissive of our Oireachtas. It didn't give us any time for debate. I wrote immediately to the Business Committee to ask that the Thánaiste come before the House to discuss the document. That's happening tomorrow. It should have happened yesterday. We got an updated document yesterday, an add-on to this contingency action plan. Very little in it, Katie. I mean, there really isn't detail.
But I'm saying, do you think the detail is being withheld from you or that the work hasn't been done?
It could be either two. I mean, deliberately, I
neither
know
is a good option.
Information has absolutely been withheld because it has gone to the media before it's gone to the Dáil. I mean, this particular document was published on the 19th of December. The Oireachtas is only debating it tomorrow. So that's just, I mean,
well,
that's
I think
a good example.
The Business Committee is not controlled by the government at all.
Well, the Business
it's
Committee isn't the problem. The problem is that you're publishing documents right when the House is about to rise and then you don't get a chance to debate those documents. Yeah. Now, the question Micheál put to the Taoiseach today was based on the exchange between Minister Ross and the Thánaiste around a question on the border. So Minister Ross was asked in a press conference, what happens if a truck comes from Scotland into the north and wants to come down to the Republic? There's a no-deal Brexit, what happens? And Minister Ross says, I think there'll be checks. And the Thánaiste nearly jumps to try and stop him speaking.
Slapped him up.
But getting worse then, when they thought the microphones were off, what was they thought was a private conversation was actually a public conversation. And the Taoiseach is basically saying, we can't talk about a border, don't go there.
Lisa, I just happened to have exactly what was
please
said.
Do, Kate.
Please do. Yeah. So Shane Ross was overheard thinking the microphones were not on, or not realising the microphones were on, was overheard saying to Simon Coveney, yeah, that border one, should I not have said that? And Simon Coveney said, yes, but we can't get into where they'll be at this stage. They could be in the sea, they could be, but look, once you start talking about checks anywhere near the border, people will start delving into that, and all of a sudden we'll be the government that reintroduced a physical border on the island of Ireland. And Shane Ross replied, yeah, but I didn't know what to say.
Now, on that particular point, Katie, you can see why we might be a bit suspicious that we're not getting all the information. I want to be very clear. I have asked face-to-face directly the Taoiseach, have you any contingency planning done on a border on this island? I have been told more than once, absolutely not. Yeah. So I have to take government at their word on that. Yeah.
That is absolutely the position, and that's what Minister Coveney said time and time again and is repeating again.
Did he not say
that there won't be a hard border? The question you're asking can be put in a different way. If you have a manifest of a cargo, you have 21 billion euros worth of trade within the EU travels between Ireland and Britain every year. So obviously those manifest, whether there's a border or not, like there is a check on goods, but there won't be physically on the border any physical presence.
How can that be though, Fergus? At the end of the day, if we end up being the frontier between the EU and and a third country,
the backstop says that there will be no.
We're talking about a no deal scenario now. We're talking about contingency planning, planning.
No, but even in a no deal scenario, the British are committed to not having a hard border.
Yeah, but it's the European Union, and even Simon Coveney admitted earlier on in the week that there would have to be difficult conversations with Europe. That's the truth of the matter.
But even if that is the case,
Fergus, didn't Leo Varadkar acknowledge some months ago before Christmas that there would have to be arrangements in relation to
Michal Martin, you have to have your electronic movement as well as your physical movement.
On the question of the European Union and the Commission, Micheál Martin today asked the Taoiseach, have you had conversations with the Commission, with Europe on this issue? And I have to say the Taoiseach looked a little bit uncomfortable and didn't answer the question. So again, we're asking questions, we're not getting information on this. There's a serious attempt, in my view, to stage manage and spin and PR all the time.
But isn't it just a matter of the Taoiseach hoping, looking across the house, thinking, listen lads, pull on the green jersey there, we really don't need to be going there at this point in time. Is that really what's in the Taoiseach's head?
What the government said.
Do you think, Fergus, that might be what the Taoiseach is thinking when he's responding to these questions in this way?
I think the facts are that the government position and the European position and the British position is that there will not be a hard border. If you're talking about movement of goods, whether from the north to the south or east-west, there will be cargo manifests travelling electronically or whatever way they are. And everybody said there will be spot checks on goods somewhere. Maybe the UK will do the spot checks over there and we'll do ours here. But there won't be a hard border. But obviously there will have to be checks.
On the green jersey issue, let me give you another example. So we've requested a Q&A session with the Taoiseach on contingency planning.
We're getting statements
tomorrow. And they have tagged on, I'm not even joking about this, we're getting 5 minutes to ask questions and receive answers in 5 minutes. So when I say that they're not being open and actually, I mean, whatever you say about Theresa May, she takes questions and she takes them regularly. And there is full debate in the comments. We're not getting the same interaction. So if you're wearing the green jersey, that's a two-way street.
But the business committee is not controlled by the government. The majority of the business committee
don't control the Taoiseach's answer.
Let's be very clear on this. If the business committee order a debate in the Dáil, it happens. Full stop.
We've just had a tweet. There won't be a hard border, reminiscent of there won't be a bailout of not too long ago. Louise, do you think that do you feel confident that whatever's been done, maybe there's a reluctance about being open about what kind of contingency planning has to be put in place?
But if there is a reluctance to share with members of the opposition what precise arrangements are in relation to contingency planning, well then of course that makes people concerned. I mean, if questions are being asked and not getting answers. And I know that from my own party, we're asking the same questions and the answers are not forthcoming. And, you know, you stated earlier that maybe on Taoiseach wants everybody to pull on the green jersey. But if he had a green jersey on himself, he wouldn't be drip feeding information into the media and letting right. that leak to those who are concerned. I think it speaks to the experience of those who are dealing with Taoiseach, actually. The facts are
that the government said yesterday that there will be meeting, that Minister Coveney will be meeting with the leaders of all the opposition parties, explaining to them the context of the legislation.
Do you think five minutes is enough?
Can I just finish my point,
please? Do you think five minutes is enough for those questions? Hold on, Fergus, maybe you will respond to that.
I'm after hearing a lot of people from one point of view, and I want to make my point of view known. And it's very simple. The government, Minister Coveney is meeting every leader of the opposition, all those different parties. Secondly, the legislation can only work if everybody knows what it is, and that the government will make them fully aware of that and get their consent for getting it through. Just let me finish the point, please, before the end of March, which is the deadline date if there is a hard Brexit. So in other words, it can only work and it can only happen with the consent of everybody. And all of the commentary is wrong in that respect.
The legislation is not so much the issue. Okay, I think the time is tight. We're getting the legislation published on the 22nd of February, but that's only a small aspect. What I'm talking about and what Louise is talking about is, for example, your contingency action plan, your big document. The media got that before I got it. That's wrong.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that.
And as well, the fact that we're not debating that document now until tomorrow and it was published on December 19th, they're the issues. Yeah.
Okay. And the 5 minutes is still an issue. I mean, 5 minutes for questions and answers over something that is that serious. I don't think that is good enough. And I asked you, Fergus, do you think 5 minutes is good enough?
It certainly isn't good enough. No.
Okay, but, so we're all in violent agreement on that one. Fergus, we're going to have to go for a break, but stay with us because after this, we will be talking about the overrun on the Children's Hospital.
Email latedebate@rte.ie. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back. You're listening to Late Debate with me, Katie Hannan, and with me here in Studio 10 are Deputy Fergus O'Dowd of Fine Gael, Deputy Lisa Chambers, Brexit spokesperson for Fianna Fáil, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin spokesperson on health and member of the Oireachtas Health Committee, Jennifer Bray from the Irish Times, and public affairs consultant Gerard Howlin. Now, earlier today, the Oireachtas Health Committee heard from the National Paediatric Hospital Development Board on overspends on the building of the new National Children's Hospital. Fianna Fáil's health spokesperson, Stephen Donnelly, called it a catastrophic failure. Here he is questioning Tom Costello, the head of the Development Board, about the figures.
I believe you and the board have failed completely and catastrophically in your job and in your obligations to the state. When the dust has settled, the original bid from BAM came in at about 640 million. Now, when the dust has settled, I don't think we're going to see any change out of much less than 2 billion. So I think you will have overspent, when this is all done, by somewhere between 1 and 1.5 billion euro, and it could be higher. Now, the entire fiscal space for the entire country last year was less than €1 billion. If you think of the work and the analysis and the oversight involved in deploying that 800 million or so euro, you and your team were down in St. James's spending more than that.
Mr. Costello accepted that they could have done better.
There are lessons to be learned in relation to the wisdom of pursuing cost reductions on competitive tenders and ensuring the sufficiency of tender information, in particular mechanical and electrical services at tender stage. This would have ensured a more accurate prediction of actual quantities and costs at the tender stage, and to a large extent it would have reduced the underestimation of costs at stage one.
Louise O'Reilly, you were a member of that health committee. You were down there today. Mm. Did you get the answers to the? Well, I mean, the
that,
figures
that was
are
one
breathtaking.
Of the answers to my questions there, that Mr. Costello that you just played. The figures are breathtaking, and I have to tell you, the performance of the board today was slightly less than breathtaking. There wasn't. there wasn't the level of detail that we would have expected for a hearing of that nature. And there wasn't, I mean, Mr. Costello was clear to say that, you know, if he had his time over, he said he'd do it the same, which I thought was quite astounding. And his explanations, I think, fell short of what we would have expected. Yeah, because we're talking about a phenomenal amount of money. It's 650 million euros originally. It is now up at 1.4 billion. The figure given by Minister Harris to Cabinet was 1.7 billion. And I don't think there's anybody who thinks that it won't tip off 2 billion. So we are talking about multiples of the original estimate. Now, one of the issues that was raised was they said that they had failed to accurately specify the prices and quantities for things like cables and sanitary ware, all of that kind of stuff. But they knew they were going to have to fit out the hospital. And the other concern, and one which we didn't get into today, but we will get into next week with the HSE, is given the massive cost overruns that exist at the moment with the National Children's Hospital, and you know, don't get me wrong, we need the Children's Hospital. We also need additional bed capacity, and it became apparent that there's not going to be very much additional bed capacity injected from this. But we do need to know, is this cost overrun going to be at the expense of other absolutely essential health projects? And those answers have not been forthcoming. And that, I think, is what's really worrying people. Also, if I can just finish on this, one of the issues that I had raised and I asked repeatedly about the communication from the board to the minister. When was the minister aware? Because the minister was out saying with confidence that the was going to be delivered on time and on budget. And I'm sure he'd like to wipe that from people's memory. I remember it, and I know other people do as well. What was the level of communication with the minister? And the responses that they gave was to describe the structure. And the structure is complicated, and to describe again the structure. And I asked how many meetings had taken place with the minister. The answer was none. But Mr. Costello did say that he bumped into the minister at events. I asked him, had they discussed the overrun? That's not clear. So, you know, it looks like a blank cheque was written, handed to people. And of course, you know, the spending has spiralled out of control. But the minister appears to believe he can put himself at arm's length from this and simply pass the buck to someone else.
Lisa Chambers, I mean, the minister... He's not a quantity surveyor. He can't be expected to know how many metres or kilometres of electrical cabling would have been required. But I suppose you would expect him to be keeping a tab on the figure as it was rising.
The minister is not a quantity surveyor.
When is your understanding of when the minister was made aware of this?
I'm not entirely sure when exactly he was made aware of it. I mean, he's not a quantity surveyor. But he's very well advised. He has far more advisors than the average deputy. He has a whole department working with him. There is a cabinet health committee. The Taoiseach is ultimately responsible. So there's a whole host of checks and balances there to make sure that ministers keep track of what they're in charge of and that things like this don't happen. How do you go from 650 billion to nearly 1.4 billion? And that means that other projects, the likes of, say, Tala, Connolly, they're delayed. God knows what else has been scrapped right across the health service that we don't even know, because they're going to have subsume some of this cost into the health budget that's already stretched. Last year, the health budget overran by 700 million. That hole was only plugged because we had huge corporate tax receipts, a bit of a windfall last year that happened to plug that. Now we have this complete catastrophic mess. Somebody needs to be held accountable, but ultimately the buck stops with the minister. The minister is in charge. That is the responsibility that comes with the privilege of holding that office. You are in charge.
That's just not a political point, it's a fact, because when James Riley, unfortunately, regrettably, abolished the board of the HSE that's now going to be reinstated, he said, I'm in charge.
Yeah.
So the minister is, unlike, for example, the ESB, where there is a statutory board between the minister and the organisation, in relation to the HSE, the minister is in charge. And Minister Harris was very quick to say precisely what he didn't know in relation to a cervical check very recently. And several people had the marks of a bus going over them as a result. But there's also something else that we need to recognise. Politicians here are quite vulnerable, generally speaking, in situations like this, because it's not just that they're not quantity surveyors, they are completely dependent on the advice they are given about costs and such like. their responsibility is to make sure the systems are in place to give them good advice that they can then depend on. That's a slightly different matter. And there's something I think that the committee needs to look at, and as Louise is honest, she may wish to consider this, is the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform. Because there are very few major capital projects of this scale and size. Individual departments would not have on the shelf in a room, in an office, the sort of people that are required to run something like this. Mm. But it is the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform that specifically has, you know, that responsibility in terms of public contracting. Yeah. And I believe there's a level of failure in its remit, but in this instance.
It's not just, because it's not just, Jennifer, it's not just that this project has started at 450 when it was down at the Matra site, then it went up to 650 million and then 1 million, and now we're up to where we are. We don't even know where we are, actually. Will it go, as Louise was saying, up towards the 2 billion mark? And even if it doesn't, it's still the most expensive hospital being built in the world. If you look at the comparators, I saw Fergal Bowers was putting together some figures today, and it was like, for a UK hospital of 200 beds, it was like a cost of less than half a million per bed. There was Australian hospitals, it was 1.5 million per bed. This is going to be 3 million per bed.
If it
comes in at what it's at now.
The costs are absolutely extraordinary. There was a sense when the story kind of first broke late last year before Christmas that maybe after Christmas it might die down or it might become less of a controversy. It's actually happening the other way around. It's becoming more of a political dynamite, basically. And, you know, I have a feeling that when all is said and done and when the truth comes out, that what you'll actually find is that warnings about, for example, the cost of construction, that those warnings will have gone back years, and that this goes beyond Simon Harris and this goes further back. I'm not saying who it lands with, but I distinctly remember having a Freedom of Information request a couple of years ago that mentioned this, which I must dig out. And I also think that Leo Varadkar promised that there would be some investigation, that he would look into it. But he hasn't really given detail about who's leading that investigation, what the parameters are, who'll be held accountable, will anybody be held accountable. And if he's not up front and doesn't show, the methods of which he conducted that investigation, we could be looking at a full-scale Oireachtas inquiry into this, which would be incredibly serious for the government. And given the figures, and also Leo Varadkar said today, he was given clarity about what's going to happen in terms of projects, etc. He said they will be delayed. Now, if you're delaying something for 10 years, it's over. And also he said...
It's gone off the agenda. And that's a big fear for people.
Exactly.
He's a former Minister for Health himself. Okay. So maybe he's investigating himself.
We've gone all the way around the House now. Fergus.
Okay, well, I think one of the points is...
Fergus, first of all.
Sorry, can I answer?
I want to ask you... I'll ask you a question first before you answer.
Oh, God.
Just give you a hint of what we might be asking, wanting to hear from you.
Thank you for having me on.
We always love having you on.
You keep looking at the clock, Fergus. You're looking to get out.
I do keep looking at the clock.
I was going to say, I don't get the sense, listening to Simon Harris, listening to the Taoiseach, that there is a... shocked and appalled as you would think we were.
Of course you are, and as the Taoiseach has said,
with the kind of money we're talking about,
I answer the charges? First of all, what are the actual additional costs? And one of them, there was no crystal ball that could say that that fire regulations would have to change as a result of obviously the Grenfell fire in the UK. The fact that the key cost drivers include detailing and itemising quantities of all the materials and fixtures required in each of the 6,000 rooms, that wasn't included in the original cost. Omissions in the original design identified and costed. 9 months of the programme across construction, increased construction labour, VAT, and so on. So, but the facts are, and I agree with people here, this is not new, unfortunately, in terms of public contracts. Now, I just want to get to one important point. I have been following this in my own area, in transport, and there's been a number of internal audits done by TII, Transport Infrastructure Ireland. There's some red line issues in those audits, and they've refused to give me information. It's now with the Information Commissioner, and I think what is actually happening is that there are huge issues about procurement in contracts, there's huge issues about design and all that, and until we get absolute clarity, a very critical detailed analysis of what is going wrong here, and it is going wrong. And the government are saying we're going to get that.
Should
exactly.
we have this inquiry that was called for today?
Well, I think if I have it correct, the Taoiseach is having an inquiry into it.
But in Iraq, this inquiry that was called for today.
What he said was they're fully committed to the project. There will be an independent review of the increased cost, and they've approved the commissioning of an independent review.
There already has been an independent review.
No, I'm only just saying what they've said.
No, no, and I understand that, and I know that you weren't at the committee this morning, but I was, and I asked the question about... They were meeting in August, Mr. Costello said, they noticed, but they noticed that maybe it was getting a bit spendy, as you might say, and they decided to meet, so the board met. Then they were meeting weekly, and then in a panic, they commissioned some independent review of the spending. And so I asked, which I thought was a fairly natural question, how much did that cost? They didn't have that information to hand. I'm sure they will supply it to us. So they knew themselves that the costs were spiralling out of control. The question that we keep coming back to is, at what point did they tell the minister? And more importantly, did the minister pick the phone up and ask? This is a major project. As the Minister for Health, this is probably the biggest project that any Minister for Health will undertake for decades. And you'd like to think that the person who is in charge of the purse strings would pick up the phone and to keep an eye on the spending. I mean, if you were getting work done at
you
home,
want
you would do
there.
It.
No, Fergus,
and
I'm not
wanting to say, but if I was getting work done at home, I'd keep an eye on the spending.
The question of at what point did the minister or what engagement did the minister have?
I think the government were given a cost, and it's now almost $500 million more than they were told.
No, but in relation to when
the minister... that'll be a question of fact that'll be easily established. I mean, the parliamentary question will establish that straight away. The other point I want to make...
But is there concern with Infinigale? Because this is politically very difficult.
And I know you're listening to me, so see with a smile. This is a huge issue for me personally in terms of overrunning state contracts. And it's something I've been following, and hopefully I've been working with somebody in the news media on it. And hopefully we get to the bottom of it. But the other fact is that historically, and I just make this point, the Port Tunnel, the Bryan Bridge, the Narrow Water Bridge, all of those public contracts for years have suddenly gone hugely over the expected price. And the trouble is that there's not enough scrutiny of what is actually going on.
So in relation to 2040, if half of it happens, it will be the biggest capital expenditure ever. Looking forward, the backward look is really important, but let's have a forward look. We need to know from the Department of Public Expenditure what substantially different is being put in place going forward so this doesn't happen again and again and again, if even some of towards 2040 ever actually happens.
At the heart of that very point,
I need to go to the transport
infrastructure internal audits on all of those capital projects. That's exactly what I'm after, to get at the facts for that.
Okay.
And we'll have them soon, hopefully.
Okay, we'll take a break there, but stay with us because we want to talk about the pending nurses' strike after this.
Tweet at Late Debate RTE. The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. You're listening to The Late Debate, and joining me in studio we have Fergus O'Dowd from Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil's Lisa Chambers, Sinn Féin's Louise O'Reilly, Jennifer Bray from The Irish Times, and Gerard Howland, Public Affairs Consultant. Now, with the first of the planned strikes by the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation just 2 weeks ago, our way today, Minister for Health Simon Harris said that any agreement on pay would have to be within the existing public service pay agreement. But is there a way to break the impasse? Are they paid enough? Louise, is this a retention and a recruitment crisis?
It is. And in fact, the figures from the Irish Nurses and Midwives Organisation, backed up by the HSE, will show that 80% of nurses and midwives who are leaving the HSE are resigning. They're not retiring. So this is not an age issue. They are resigning. They're going to work in the private sector. They're going to work abroad. I met a young nurse today, newly graduated. Her name is Tara. She was in the gallery while we had the debate today, and I spoke to her afterwards, and she told me that she had been given a gift of €25 from her granddad, and that was how she had any money in her purse at all. She's leaving, she's going to London, she'll be there next month. She's going to be paid £39,000 sterling. She's going to get a relocation grant, and she's going to get some assistance with housing. So if there wasn't a recruitment and retention crisis, we wouldn't have a recruitment and retention crisis, but we do. We can't recruit and we cannot retain nurses.
When the Pay Commission looked at this last year, they said that there wasn't a recruitment or a retention crisis.
No, that's not true. They said they acknowledged that there was an issue, but what they believed that it could be dealt with.
They said there wasn't a general issue. They said that in very specific parts of the nursing health service, there was some issues. There wasn't a general issue with retention or with recruitment, and they also said that what issues there were would not be fixed by pay, that pay wasn't the overriding issue.
Mm-hmm. And the findings of the Public Service Pay Commission have been rejected by the Nurses and Midwives Organisation and by the Psychiatric Nurses Association. And the reason that they have is because they are dealing every day with the effect of recruitment and retention. So, for example, you know, if you're looking at ratios, 1 to 4 is considered good, 1 to 8 is considered dangerous, 1 nurse to 8 patients is considered... on the dangerous level. We're routinely in our hospitals operating off ratios of 1 to 16. And, I mean, that cannot continue. But so if you talk to nurses and midwives, they will tell you that they're voting with their feet.
I'm quoting from the Business Post last Sunday. Yeah. There was a major piece done by Susan Mitchell, who I think is a very respected health journalist. Mm-hmm. And she's saying that we have 11.6 nurses per 1,000 compared with an EU average of 8.4. We've Pascal Dunne, who was quoted as saying that the number of nurses in the system has increased by about 11% over the last 4 years. Again, that would challenge the idea of there being a recruitment issue.
The numbers are down since 2006. If you take it over that time, but also if you look, and I did read Susan Mitchell's article, and you know, if you look at the ratio, that's grand, but you're not comparing like with like. So if you're going to compare this state with another country where they might have a very well developed primary care system, we have a very hospital centric system, and you know, I mean, we know this. The best route into the health service can often be through the hospital. That requires a high level of nursing and midwifery. Now, if the government were minded to, they could implement this longitudinal report, they could put some real money behind it, and they could really, really work on shifting to the community where you can deliver care cheaper. But under the current model that we have, what we effectively have are unsafe working conditions and overcrowded working conditions.
Yeah, I mean, Gerard Howland, I mean, when you spend, and I had the unpleasant experience of spending a night in an A&E just a short time ago, and you do get the sense that nurses are literally running from patient to patient. You do get a sense that we could do with, you know, at least as many again in the ward. What do you make of, in terms of the numbers that we're playing around with here?
Well, we have severe shortages of a lot of things in our health system, principally doctors and beds, but by no measurement. And Susan Mitchell's piece in last Sunday Business Post went through this in great detail, allowing for what Louise says, is a different healthcare model here, allowing for various differences. We're still very well nursed in terms of total numbers. It was also a finding of the Pay Commission that the average nurse, who mysteriously we never hear from, earns, HSE nurse, I should say, 51,000, including overtime and allowances, I should add. And if that's an average, there must be many higher.
Corporate nurses receive allowances, and those who receive additional money for working on social hours deserve that money. They work on weekends and
I didn't say they didn't deserve it, but I, looking at this not from the special interest of nurses but the public interest, and I don't believe that this pay claim is in the public interest.
Okay, I'm conscious of time, very tightness.
We're not comparing like with like, so a big difference, we take Australia, where Australia is where a lot of our nurses are going, so it's one of the locations. Their working conditions are very different. They have a good working environment. It's not chaotic. So if you've got less nurses, you can actually do more work if you've got access to an MRI machine, the CT scans, you've got proper admin staff.
You often hear from nurses as well saying they have a career structure in particular.
Progression. But the one thing that we keep getting back is working conditions. When you said you spent a night in A&E, it's chaotic. There's no space, there's no beds, the systems aren't working. That makes your job doubly as hard. And that's why, you know, numbers aren't reflective of the actual conditions that they're working
in. Calling for
an independent commission chaired by a judge to actually assess pay, conditions, career progression, all of those issues, because it really is a multi-issue There's lots of aspects.
And that was in the Sinn Féin PMB passed in April. But what we've done is we've put down an amendment which will firm up the time on that, because an open-ended commission is not going to help in the resolution of an industrial
dispute. Would Fianna Fáil support the amendment?
Our PMB was debated tonight, and we haven't discussed as a party the amendment, but I'm sure there are health both persons, Dean Donnelly, will be looking at that.
I think I agree absolutely with Gerard. There are 3,330 more nurses working today in Ireland than there were 5 years ago, and that's excluding people who may have retired.
You don't think...
No, can
you
I just don't, make my I'm point? Just, I'm hearing,
I know, but,
fairness,
but the key point
I
is...
I want to make Fergus, my point
but
is
Fergus,
this,
the key point
that
is
anything that can be negotiated within the existing pay agreement and between the different parties is helpful, but there's no way the government can move outside of that. There's no way there can be a special pay agreement for anybody, because and, we already have a consensus.
And can there be a movement within the pay agreement?
Of course
agreement,
you can. That's why they're meeting, and they're meeting again on Friday.
In terms of public sector pay, nurses are hard Brexiteers. I mean, let's call it spade a spade.
Does anyone want to say something nice about nurses before we...
I say something nice about nurses every day of the week. I was proud to represent them for over a decade. They are wonderful
people. Okay, balance. Okay, we're just coming up at the end of the programme. Jennifer, do you believe that there will be any movement on this? Because we heard Pascal Donohue out today. We heard Simon Harris out today speaking very tough on this.
Yeah, I don't know. I think if you're likely to see anything, it's probably going to be some kind of fudge, because the government, if they give money to the nurses, their position is that the whole pay agreement unravels and that they'd be left on the hook for hundreds of millions. I'm not saying that.
So
I
we are facing into a strike more than
but
likely.
It's a game of poker, really. Will the nurses go all the way down to the line when we're coming in for Brexit, a cold snap, flu season?
And with a 95% ballot for industrial action,
do they want to be the government that presided over a massive strike and thousands of cancelled operations
in the run-up to election?
Yes.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. A few headlines from tomorrow. The Times is with "It's up to you, Mrs. May." The Financial Times: "May start search for Brexit ideas after narrow confidence vote win." The Guardian: "May survives vote, but Britain remains in Brexit deadlock." Tonight's programme was produced by Penny Hart. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan, and Ruth Kennington was on sound. And now it's over to Cathal Murray on Late Date.